Welcome to the Supertone Show. The show's co-hosted by Simon Campbell and myself, Susie Starlight. We're both musicians, write songs, and we run a vintage residential recording studio in Estavella, Valencia, Spain.
Yes, we do.
See. He's been hailed by Rolling Stone magazine as the most important record producer to emerge in the 80s.
Is this me?
He's known as a performance mixer because he uses his mixing console as an instrument. I'm not listening or talking to you. And he has 7 Grammys underneath his belt. Maybe on his belt. He is Daniel Lanois.
Thank you.
Daniel Lanois.
Yes, it is, of course.
What was that track called again?
That was Where the Hawk Wind Kills.
That's and kind of a dramatic title.
It is. It is a dramatic title. That track was, it's not the most popular from the album, Akedi, which was his first solo album, I believe. But it's a song I particularly like from that record. Some magnificent sounds in this great, you know, atmosphere. And I think that's what Daniel Lanois really's done. I mean, he's a great atmosphere man. He creates this feel through his mixing. Mm. And, of course, he captures the feel of the musicians when he's recording them, which is his big thing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. He's quite cinematic, I think, in his sonic landscape. I know that might sound a mouthful.
Holy shit, cinematic in his sonic landscape.
I just
very
listened
large
to what I said.
In his underpants.
Well, I know from having watched the documentaries and just, you know, read the odd article with an interview with him, he was very much influenced by cinema, and he loves, you know, to think of music having pictures and brushstrokes. So the reason I remember it is because that's how I like to music evokes pictures in me, so it kind of makes sense. But you can definitely feel his big landscapes, can't you? It's quite, there's a lot of space and very dramatic, and it has a big feel. It has something to say.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, he's gained popularity over the years as a producer, but mainly in the sort of 90s, didn't he? 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And as you'll hear later on, you know, he's done some massive records, very varied content. But, you know, what I do like about him is that he has a very, very similar ethos to we do here, in the fact that he likes to record everybody together. He talks about the fact that the most important thing about the recording is the people in the room. And he'll choose from people within the room to get the best feel. Whoever's there, he will try and use them to the best abilities.
Yeah, there's no kind of call London, we need a replacement.
Exactly.
He doesn't do that, does
no.
he? From what we understand, anyway.
Yeah, and later on we'll find out a little bit more about the tracks he's recorded and talk a little bit more about them. But anyway, that was from his first album, Akedi.
See, do you know what his middle name is?
Because
I didn't know until yesterday.
Albert.
Same name as my dad. Roland.
No.
I know.
Roland.
Yeah. And he was born
Daniel
in...
Daniel Roland Lanois. No.
And he was born in Hull.
Who?
Daniel Lanois.
No, that's ridiculous.
But no, Hull in Quebec, oh, Canada.
I thought he was Hull in... I thought that was a bit fishy. Whoa! No.
No, it's just these little bits of, it's just little bits of detail, isn't it, that you kind of piece together. Because when you kind of relate to someone's work, you sometimes just want to know a little bit more to see if you have other things in common as well, in terms of the influences and how that shaped the reason why he's making the kind of music that he does and did, because he was 17 when he set up a recording studio in the basement of his parents' house. Mm. You know, and it's all started from there, all that experimentation. I got you there, though.
Well, you did, yeah, that really got me. You really got me going. But Lanois, though, is French-Canadian, of course. On this album as well, Akedi, and if you haven't heard it, I would urge you to listen to it. It's a very fine album indeed, and he does a lot of French stuff on there as well, and breaks into English occasionally. But he's got a lot of folk roots. You know, he plays a lot of acoustic guitar. He's a lovely guitar player himself, you know. Mm. And I think that's one of the things that he says about the reason why he's a good producer, the fact he can relate to the musicians.
Yeah.
And he often contributes to pieces by playing guitar on them and, you know,
well, I think he said that, you know, he thinks that that's his greatest asset, is his gift as a musician when he's working with people.
I thought the greatest asset, he came from Hull.
Smells of fish.
Rather like the spiders from Mars.
Used
of course.
To smell.
Yeah, that's right. Used to smell.
Yeah,
fish.
Yeah, of course.
We love Hull.
Yes,
we love
absolutely.
Grimsby. We love all around there because our website's just been designed by Laser Red, or Red Laser, I should say. Red Laser.
Spanish for you, making us swap the words around.
Indeed,
we're doing a Yoda.
It. Yeah, yeah, a bit of Yoda action. Anyway, let's get on with the next track.
Yeah. So Daniel was hanging out with Peter. Sounds like a Ladybird children's book, doesn't it?
Daniel was hanging out with Peter and they all
and
went
Peter
for a nice
picnic. Peter was doing the soundtrack
to
a film called Birdie and then he was going to do an album. And Peter thought, who shall I get? Shall I get Niall or shall I get Daniel? And anyway, it transpired that Daniel got.
But Adolf plays with Brit. No, Adolf builds a bonfire and Adolf plays. I can't remember what it is now. Yes, this very track, this very album, in fact.
Strong, we were wanted all along. I was taught to fight, taught to win. I never thought I could fail. No fight left, or so it seems. I am a man whose dreams have all deserted. I've changed my face, I've changed my name, but no one wants. That river's flowing.
Give Up, Peter Gabriel, from the album So, which was his fifth studio album, and it was nominated for a Grammy for Album of the Year as well. Fantastic.
Hardly surprising.
Yeah. Do you know that when I listen to that song, it's like it melts your heart, and you're on the point of crying by the end of it. But it doesn't, the sadness isn't so deep, but it's just so beautiful.
Well, I don't know. Sadness is deep for me because, I mean, it's all about, of course, you know, unemployment and hopelessness when it, you know, a man loses his job and he's got a family to support. And it's an incredibly powerful song. Yeah, it's my favourite Peter Gabriel song by far, you know. Even, you know, with all the Genesis stuff and everything else, I think it's the one that is, the lyric is by far the best. And, of course, you know, I mean, we're talking about Lanwar today and the production is magnificent, magnificent. It's, you know, it's got the Chapman stick on it, that beautiful Chapman stick playing. And it wasn't actually done at Real World Studios. I thought it was done at Real World Studios.
No.
Right, which is Peter Gabriel's place. Just tell us about it.
It was, well, Peter Gabriel was living in a place called Ashcombe House, which is just outside of Bath in England.
Is that like Bath?
Yeah.
Same place.
Same thing.
Okay. For your Americans, we have, yeah, so it's for the south of England, the posh people, they go, Bath. And then for us northern men and women of rock, we go, Bath. Anyway.
Yeah. The Bath. Bath, whatever. B-A-T-H.
Yes, we got it.
Gabriel, when I was reading about him, he was saying that he just finished the soundtrack to Birdie and he was considering, you know, who to work with to produce this album. And he eventually invited Daniel Lanwar to stay on and work with him on this album. And he had a studio outside in a converted barn, and it was just two rooms. And this album was recorded using a U-47 tube mic.
Yeah, we got one of those.
For the vocals.
Yeah.
And magnificent. They had two analog 24-track machines and a Decca compressor with no EQ.
Well, we've got a Decca compressor as well. So that means anybody who wants to sound like that can come here. It's no problem. Anyway, plug over.
Yeah.
Including Daniel, of course. Good night, Daniel. I might start calling.
Dan.
Yeah.
Danielle. But I think they were saying as well that Lanwar's contribution to that, obviously with the rhythmic, because they were experimenting a lot as well, it's noted that he sort of gave each note sort of room to breathe. It was quite textured. And there was one thing that Peter Gabriel was saying that he learned from Lanwar, which was a total respect for the magic of the moment, that there's a real consciousness of when the performance is good. And Daniel had a really good knack for knowing, you know, when you're taking a few takes and then like the second take, you go, oh, that's the one. And you do a third take and you go, no, that's the one. Hang on. Which one was the one that had the magic moment?
Yeah.
And I think it's really good when you do have a producer, you can actually sort of be aware. And I think he's got a really good radar for that, to sort of know, probably when the hair's on his arms, I don't know. For me, it's always when I get that feeling and you kind of go, oh, that touched me. Something happened in that take.
You see, he's also doing it on tape, which is, you know, and I'm not being old man in the sea here, but in the old days when you used to do it on tape, you had a restricted amount of tape. I mean, Peter Gabriel probably had lots of tape, but to actually rewind it and get it back to a place where you could listen to the take again does take a defined amount of time. And, you know, at 30 inches per second, a 2-inch tape, a reel of 2-inch tape goes very, very quickly. Mm. So you might have to put another tape on. So to listen to 5 or 6 different takes could take half a day.
Yeah.
Unlike now on Pro Tools, where you can just select between them and say, oh, that was really nice and stuff. But, you know, so I think the producer had to pay a lot more attention to what was going on and also commit to something and say, right, that was the take. And so do we spend half a day listening to all the different takes, or do you trust the producer to say, right, that was the take and go with that one? You know, so, I mean, it has changed now, but has it changed for the better? This is the question.
I don't know. I think all I know is that if the other thing that Peter Gabriel was saying about why this album works so well is that the band were connected and they were listening to each other and firing off each other. And I do think they had an experimental approach as well. And I do think if you've got a good energy in the room and connectivity with the band who are firing off each other, I think that counts more than how much technology you've got.
Well, absolutely.
Because you can't make a feel out of...
Absolutely. And those vocals, I mean, Kate Bush, what a beautiful voice. And you know, and his voice together. I mean, they were... Were they an item at the time? I can't remember.
I don't know.
Or were they ever an item? I think they were at some stage.
Do you know, and I never really bothered by all that. I guess you would... you could... The video for me, when I saw it on Top of the Pops, they were just holding each other and they were being... You could tell it was in the round... Or there was something circular going on. And it was very simple and very tender. And I guess the little romantic in me would be thinking, oh, isn't that quite beautiful? But I quite liked it, that I sensed that they were friends. But I think you, for me, it's not important what they were doing. It's maybe how it made me feel. Because the song, once you give it out there, really is how it becomes a part of your life if you connect with it.
Absolutely.
Put it into your storyline, don't you?
Yeah, it's become a part of my life, that song.
Yeah.
So anyway, Daniel Lanois, he has been producer, as we've said earlier on in the show, of many albums. And somebody who I never thought that he might produce popped up. And obviously he'd had connections with the band over the years, because everybody had connections.
The band.
The band. Yeah, not a band, but the band. Because I know that he had a lot to do with the keyboard player, and who's played on his later albums, hadn't he?
Yeah.
But Robbie Robertson is like was really one of the chief songwriters from the band, even though many of the band hate to actually recognise it, and some there's been a lot of hoo-ha about who actually wrote this song. But anyway, Daniel Lanois produced his first solo album.
Laying in the back seat listening to Little Willie John. time stood still. You know, I think I'm gonna go down to Madame X and let her read my mind. She said that voodoo stuff don't do nothing for me.
I'm a man with clear destination. I'm a man with broad imagination. You fog the mind, you stir the soul.
Robbie Robertson and Somewhere Down the Crazy River.
What a sound. The great thing about Lanois, and, you know, I love this man. I've never met him. Hopefully we will do. But his attention to the ambience of the track. I mean, for one thing, the drum sounds. And I know it's all a little bit sort of 80s. It's a little bit different than perhaps you'd do now. It's less real. But, you know, the drum sound, that's fantastic. The kick drum is beautiful. But his vocal, you know, when he's talking. And Robert Robertson's got a great voice, we know that. But he's got some... he's really captured it, you know, recording it. He's got it. And when he breaks into the actual singing, you know, it's just tremendous. I just love the ambience of it and that swimminess about it. It's just a beautiful recorded track as far as I'm concerned.
There's for me, there are two aspects. It's like the space, the texture of his vocals, and the groove in that song was incredibly sexy.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, because that's all it is, really. Because actually, it's all about that. You know, Somewhere Down the Crazy River. The song is very simple. It's just about that first line of the chorus, really. The rest of it's ambience and delivering a lyric. You know.
But I know that Lanois thinks that the groove's really important, and that it's kind of similar to like a physical ecstasy. And I think I'm starting to
physical ecstasy. Holy shit.
It's funny though, because sometimes when I'm playing bass and I get in on a bit of a groove on a
bass. What, you play bass?
Yeah, just a little bit. It gets me, and it just completely puts you into a trance like thing, and you kind of feel it, you know, and you can feel the groove in that song, I could almost see Barry White eating a flake. To me, it's like that sexy voice with chocolate, you know?
Yeah.
It's all these images.
Well, I'm sure he'd be very proud about that, to say it was very sexy and sounded of chocolate, you know?
In a not a sordid way either. Well, just a little hint of maybe naughtiness.
Naughtiness. Well, anyway, I think we should move swiftly
move along.
Because talking of the groove, this next track, the drummer on this next track is Brian Blade. And Brian Blade is a long-term collaborator with Daniel Lanois. And we've been watching videos recently and really getting into Lanois, into his very soul, really. And Brian Blade looks awkward when he's drumming. But he's got just a very unusual and great groove. He does things that are just slightly different. And a drummer that we've been working with recently, who's been a client of the studio a couple of times, and we're going to be working with later on in the year on our own stuff, a guy called Jorge Rossi, who's an amazing. He deps occasionally. Yeah, he occasionally deps for Brian Blade. So there's a similar sort of thing going on, you know. But this next track, you know, it's somebody very famous you're instantly going to recognise. Well, if you're a music lover, you're instantly going to recognise. Certainly, if you're a country lover, you're going to recognise. But just listen to these drums.
All the streets are crammed, and there's glass everywhere. And a baby stares out with a motherless eye. I'm he's never seen love. An addiction stays on tight like a glove.
Where Will I Be? Emmylou Harris from the controversial, amazing Grammy Award-winning album Wrecking Ball.
Mm. And well, Brian Blade, again, when you listen to the drums on that, it is truly outstanding. His playing's outstanding. The sound is great. Daniel Lanois wrote that song, right?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he wrote three for that album.
Right.
He was totally and utterly committed to it. He was into it.
And what did it get a Grammy for? The best?
Best contemporary. Let's have a look. It was best contemporary folk album.
Wow. Well, it's when we say it's controversial, it was, because I remember when it came out, and Emmylou apparently was getting death threats because she's the queen of country, and all of a sudden this Canadian comes down there. I believe that they were romantically engaged. He swept her off her feet, apparently, and they created this record, which is something completely different than anything she'd ever done. No conventional pedal steel guitar. It was Lanois in the background, all that
yeah.
shit. And even on that, I mean, really, it's all about a vocal and the drums. That's it, really. And then there's all that texture in the background, and occasionally you get some bass in there. But and again, an amazing atmospheric production that took that artist up somewhere that she'd never been before, and really gave her something different, which you can listen to now, and I think it sounds very contemporary even now.
Yeah, because we played this a few years ago. I remember when we sat down and we were like, "Oh my God, you know, what a fantastic album this is!" But with Emmylou though, she said that she smoked country music but never inhaled it. I think she's amazing, but I think that means that she's influenced, you know, it shows that she's influenced by a broader scope of artists, you know, from the sort of country, blues, folk through to the protest songs. She's not specifically of one genre and doesn't have to stick with that format and refuses to do so. And why should she, you know?
Well, on some of the other bits of the album, though, Larry Mullen Jr. from U2 was playing drums on it, which, again, a very odd choice because you think he's a rock and roll drummer. Well, he is a rock and roll drummer. But Lanois, he keeps popping these people into unusual situations. And if you listen to the rest of the record, which I urge you to do again, it really is amazing because it does sound like Larry Mullen Jr., but it's sort of... It's in a different context, you know?
Yeah, but that's the thing. I think that it's... From what Lanois was has always been trying to achieve is experimentation and trying to do some create sounds that haven't been heard before. So when you have that fusion of different musicians from different musical backgrounds and influences, you know hopefully you can come out with something that is slightly different, you know, and refreshing, because they chose. It was like an eclectic choice of relatively obscure songs for that album by renowned artists as well. So, but she makes them very much her own, very deep and very emotional.
Well, she covered Wrecking Ball, which is the name of the album, of course, by Neil Young.
I think he sang vocals on that as well, actually.
I'm in a wrecking ball! Yeah. Some of that shit is normal stuff. Yeah. I'm making fun of him there, but we do love Neil Young
He's a good bloke, isn't he, really?
He's
troublesome.
Is. Yeah, whether he is good or not, I don't know, but he's certainly...
I think he's troublesome.
Very, very troublesome.
And that's always a good thing, really.
Indeed.
But when they... did I tell that story about how Lanois met Brian Blade?
Yeah.
Because he'd moved over to New Orleans for a bit because he wanted to soak up sort of the atmosphere of New Orleans, and he was saying it was like... had very similar neighbourhood tones to when he was growing up in Quebec. And he said it's like where all the forefathers of the groove came from, like Fats Domino and Louis Armstrong and Little Richard, who keeps popping up all
he
the
does.
Time, as you would expect.
One of Lemmy's heroes.
Yes, indeed. Mm. Indeed. And the story goes that Lanois was walking past a nightclub in New Orleans and he heard these drums and he had to follow the sound of the drums. And hoping they'd carry on playing so the bass solo wouldn't start, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah,
yeah, and he basically met Brian Blade through hearing his playing and had to meet him and just thought, oh my God, I've got to work with this guy. And that's long, long time ago now.
Yeah, and he keeps popping up on lots of albums.
Yeah.
And the engineer on this is a guy from Manchester, isn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, Mark Howard.
Right.
Yeah.
Not Frankie Howard.
No,
he was
Mark.
A comedian. Right, okay.
Mark. Yeah. He's got a very similar ethos to
Frankie
Lamar.
Howard. No. No. Yeah, well, it's rumoured that, I mean, he has a lot to do with the sound of Lamb Wild stuff over the years, because he's very particular about what he does and how he uses technology, doesn't he?
Yeah, well, they're both about the feel, because Mark was saying that performance will always outweigh perfection, and you can feel a performance in your heart. That's the barometer that he kind of works off. And he's saying like a lot of records come out today, they have no feelings, they don't evoke any sounds. They might sound cool, but there's no emotion. They're just like a machine robbed of humanity. So, you know, you can tell why these guys work together and have done for a long time.
Yeah, and he uses dark mics and digital desks. He doesn't trust analog desks, apparently.
Because they keep
breaking on him. Of course, I disagree with him, but... Going to keep breaking down, and he has to mess around with it.
He said that the digital machines, you know, they're quite sterile, so he has to compensate for that by, you know, using a dark mic to try and get that creaminess, that life back into it.
Yeah.
So if you have an analog machine, then you're way to go, really, because to me, anyway, well, we're a bit biased, but...
Well, we are biased.
We are, totally, yeah. Actually.
But you can't argue with this boy, because he's actually recorded some amazing stuff. But I don't think he's had anything to do with this next band that we've already mentioned.
Yeah. Now, when I found out that Lamoir produced these guys, after hearing all the soundscapes and this ambient texture and the intimacy of the vocals... and all that space, there's no way would I have put these two together.
No, but Brian Eno did.
Is it getting better? Or do you feel the same? Will it make it easier on you now? You got someone to blame. You say one love, one life, when it's one need in the night. One love, we get to share it. Leaves you, baby.
September.
You too.
One.
You
not
too.
Not two, but one. You two over there. I'm looking at our studio hounds here. There's two of them. So
they're curled up.
Yeah, so you two. What the fuck's all about?
When I was listening to that track then, though, I can hear now Lanois across the whole thing, inside everything. There's space. A lot of instruments there. And there's a lot of space for each instrument. It fits quite beautifully together, doesn't it? A lot of clarity.
Well, a couple of things about that in the fact that the Edge has always used lots of echo on his guitar, and he's always had these big long repeating echoes, starting off by using the Memory Man and his AC30s when he first started off. And if you listen to Lanois, he also used a lot of echo, like on Arcady and all his later albums. He used an awful lot of echo on his pedal steel and everything, and you wonder who got it off who. But I suspect that Lanois got it off the Edge, actually, because I think he'd listened to him and he really liked that very, very big ambient sound. So the two were made in heaven to work together, really, because they're both into that. The Edge has got this tremendous talent for laying these big beds of guitar sound down.
Yeah.
You know, the rhythm section are just really rocking it out. They're just doing what they do. Very, very simple rhythms, you know, and it's all down at the Edge and Bono.
Yeah.
But it is incredible. And then you hear also bits of Eno in there, all these strange textures in the background, these electronic things that are going on, you know. But it is a basic rock and roll song. It's a great song, of course, you know, one of the great songs.
Yeah.
When you two were cool, because they were cool. For all those folks out there who don't think they were cool, they were cool at one stage, you two. And it's a marvellous record. Mm. And this won a Grammy, didn't it, as
yeah.
well? Yeah. He's won loads of Grammys for you two, hasn't he?
Yeah. What I really like is the working relationship between Eno and Lanois. I really like that. It inspires me when you see people who have kind of connected and hang out and chat, and like Eno saying, you know, I tell people I don't like sort of keep anything hidden. I'm very happy to tell people how I make music, you know, and just to sort of say, like, everything comes from nothing, and that you can have a great idea, but put in the wrong situation, it can turn to shit. Or you can have something that's shit, but in the right situation, that becomes magnificent.
Mm.
And to have that mindset Eno was saying about his mindset about it's really important that you have a good mindset. It's like, I could do something, not I'm shit, I can't. To actually go, you know, I could do this and I want to do it, and to have a positive outlook.
Mm.
I've got a lot of time for that guy, you know, because he's quite inclusive.
Well, yeah, and also he's highly intelligent. He's a very intelligent man. I mean, you know, is this the same man that we saw in huge silver platforms with Roxy Music when they first came up? Because you look at it, and I mean, those first singles, again, Roxy Music, great band.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, a stalwart in that band. He really made a lot of difference to the sound. But it's incredible that he's come so far, or perhaps he's always been like that. It's just that now he's capable of talking about it without all the pomp and ceremony of glam and all those other things he's been through. Because he's, you know, he really got into the ambient thing. And, you know, he's known really as a solo artist for his ambient music. And he's worked with Lanois on a lot of that as well, hasn't he? With, who's that Bud character? Harold Budd?
Well, it was, there's a guy called Harold Budd and Lanois. They worked on an album in 1984 called The Pearl. But the year before that, they worked on Apollo Atmospheres and Soundtracks with Brian, and I think he's got a brother because he's called Roger Eno.
I think
Roger.
I think Roger's Roger. A fucking rabbit.
No.
Who killed him? So he's never
Brian
appeared since. So
and Roger.
I think Roger is the rabbit that was killed, right? So that's where he's never made another appearance on another album.
It's great that.
Who killed Roger? Right, okay.
Yeah, but right, let's. I just want to talk about this bit as well, because talking about the beginnings, like Lanois was saying that he started off playing like a penny whistle, and that his mum used to give him like a dollar every week to go to the cinema, and that one week he saw this penny whistle and decided to buy that instead of going to the cinema. You see, now everybody starts somewhere. Mm. And even if you're... And it shouldn't be an ageist thing either, because that kind of really pisses me off a lot.
What?
Well, that you... That we're all kids. We're all kids. We're all kids. No matter how long our bodies have lived for, we're all kids. We might think that we're doing the best thing because we think we've got responsibility and we have to grow up and do certain things. But, you know, we're all kids. And I really love that about that, just creating and carrying on. Just and this whole... I got to stop because, you know me, I do tend to ramble on a bit. But I just love their inspiration.
Yeah.
And they were totally, and still are. If you're totally into something, just do it.
Yeah.
Do it.
And, you know, talking of just doing it.
Yeah.
Our next artist has done it an awful lot in various guises.
Thank you. Jamaica. Oh, river.
Maker with the dulcet tones of Willie Nelson.
Very fucking dulcet. You know, I'm going to be completely controversial. I've never liked his voice, you know. I've never really liked it. But it's one of those things. It's like Neil Young. When I first started listening to Neil Young, I hated his voice. And then it sort of grows, and Willie Nelson's the same. But what I do like about that, because we got excited during that track, listening to Emmylou Harris trying frantically in a very professional way to hang on to where he was going to come in, because he's going, burn it, you know, and it's like he's ahead of the beat, he's behind the beat, he's all over the fucking beat.
He's organic, man.
And she's trying to, yeah, but that slightly brokenness in terms of the harmonies. I mean, when they are together, it's quite beautiful, but when it's broken, it's also beautiful.
Yeah, see, and there's the where there's no perfection. He just is. That song evokes like treacle toffee with turf and ripped denim. That's the new perfume. But to me, that's like Willie Nelson with this kind of hint of red neckerchief and that rugged beard of his. And I like he feels rootsy, and it's not supposed to be perfect. And he's just is what he is. And I like that. I like that.
Well, that's right. I mean, the amount of marijuana he smokes and the amount of American taxpayers' money he's made off with. They got him eventually, didn't they? I think the IRS, and he ended up being bankrupt. But it doesn't matter to Willie Nelson. He's cool. He's got his guitar and he's... But, you know, he's such a legend and such a beautiful soul, I believe.
Yeah.
It was clear in that record that there was something, you know, going on and an energy there. Because again, we've got Emmylou in there who had worked with Lanvoir in the past. And again, it's a different sound. It's quite a different sound. It's a bit more, a bit harder than the normal swimmy reverb and echo laden productions. But
it's quite beautiful though, so that different producers bring different colours to the table. Mm. I think it's quite a beautiful thing that he's done, really.
Yeah. And again, the whole way that the track's put together, it sounds, and I hate to mention it, but it sounds like the bass was sampled from the original track, because, of course, The Maker was off Daniel Lanvoir's first album, Akkadi. His most famous, the one that's been covered more than anything else's track.
It's quite creamy, his version,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, and that harmony bass... during it sounds like it's been nicked completely with different drums and different rhythm parts and stuff, but it sounds like it's been sampled, which does go a little bit against his sort of recording it all in one room thing. But you never know, you might need to, you know. Emmylou might have been in Nashville, you know, Willie might have been in Arkansas or whatever, and they were doing it at the same time due to time, because you don't know.
No.
But anyway, it's that's Willie Nelson.
I like the way that Lanvoir says about, when he's asked about his heroes, he kind of says his heroes are the people that are in the room with him at that moment, and that he gets, the main thing is to get your artists excited, and once you've got them into that space of real excitement about the project they're working on, that's when you get the performance.
Mm.
And I like his ethos for that.
Well, so do I. Which brings us on, of course, to the penultimate track, and another man of extremely dubious
troublesome
vocal quality, troublesome in every, politically, emotionally, sonically, spiritually, everything about this guy is troublesome.
And he was very keen on borrowing people's records.
That's right.
Believe.
Yeah. So just take a listen to this.
Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs, broken idols, broken heads, people sleeping in broken beds. Ain't no use jiving, ain't no use joking. Everything is broken. Broken bottles, broken plates, broken switches.
Bob Dylan, Everything is Broken.
Again recorded in New Orleans at the same time as Akkadee.
Yeah, 89.
Yeah. Bob can't sing, can't play harmonica, but he's brilliant. He's a brilliant singer and brilliant harmonica player in his
own style.
Yeah, his own style. Incredible. And what a great song. But this album, and then again got another Grammy. It was the most successful album of Bob Dylan for, 20 years or something crazy when this came out. But it's got such an alive sound. It's beautiful. Cyril Neville's on there, one of the mighty Neville brothers, playing bongos, I think. I mean, you hear plenty of bongos in that all the way through it.
The groove on that song.
Yeah.
It's very addictive, and it has a bit of a Pink Panther-esque kind of feel to it. And a bit of Peter Sellers just poking, with Clouseau just around, poking his head around in a corner.
But but you're right about the groove. The bass is fantastic, it's great. Great line, pumping. But he's captured it again.
Yeah, and that's Lamoir's approach to rhythm, which distinguishes him as a really, a great producer to understand that and bring that to the table.
I think also with this, what he's done is that he recorded this in a house again. And we're not exactly sure where, we can't find an awful lot about it, but I think he likes recording in houses, does Daniel Lanois.
Yeah.
And this Howard character did the studio installation, because what he seems to do is that Lanois rocks at white gloving it, and this...
Mark Howard
puts all his studio installation in before. To make it all happen. But I think this fact that you're recording in a house and you're recording in somebody's home in some very basic conditions really makes a difference. It gets people more relaxed. It gets the whole thing,
Yeah, that's what happened with, I know we're going to slightly move on, but with the last house installation they did together, Neil Young rocked up and wanted to record, and they did La Noise just a couple of years ago. And it's the same thing in a house, set up a studio, you know, recording the hallway everywhere. It just gives you so many more options, and it's more organic, and it just, it's a different inspiration.
Well, yeah. I mean, we watched, as we sort of indicated before, we watched the DVD here.
I can't believe you're going to say that, because it's like here is with here's what is.
Yeah,
and I can never ever remember it right. Neither can I. But anyway, here's what is, or something.
But it's a great video.
Yes.
Some dodgy sort of video in it. Oh, Starlight don't particularly like it anyway, but...
Well, I know where he's coming from. There's an erotic dancer in it, and I can see. It's just, for me, it kind of sometimes doesn't relate to the music I'm hearing, and it's obviously his vision, not mine, but...
But it's a great insight into him and his work and the way he does stuff, and he's actually a lovely guy. I think
he is lovely.
You know, a friend of ours who should remain nameless, but he's in Nashville... And he really doesn't like Lanvoir because he's had dealings with him, and he really doesn't like him, and he says he's a bit of an arrogant guy. But from what I can see and his work, you know, I think you've got to have a bit of ego and a bit of arrogance to be great.
You've got to know what you like and what you don't.
You know, and if you haven't got any self-assurance and a bit of ego, walking in a room with fucking Bob Dylan, one of the greatest songwriters of all time, you know, just as good as any of the Beatles and all this, you know. And to walk in a room with them and say, right, we're going to produce it like this. You're going to sit in this fucking chair. We're doing it in a house, you know, and you're going to sing your songs, and we're going to do three takes, and we're going to have everybody, you know, playing at the same time. It would have been chaos for him, I would have thought. And unless you've got a little bit of balls, you know, balls of steel to go in. And like you too, I mean, for Christ's sake, you know, doing you too, or Emmylou Harris, any of these artists that we've heard before, they're massive.
Well, it's like, well, we've got to sign up, you know, the more ego you've got, it means the less knowledgeable you are, and that's the kind of feel of it, is that really, there's a difference between being arrogant with it and being mean to people, and actually just focusing on the project and just really believing in it and what you want to do, because... I haven't got time. I wouldn't give 2p to that kind of thought, really. Yeah. I'm not interested in that. But with what is inspiring though is that he has worked with a diverse range of artists and is continuing to do so. And recently, of the last, because he's got a band, Black Dub now, Daniel, and he was saying that he was more into like the ambient soundscapes before, but now he's kind of evolving. And it was only a couple of years ago when he actually said, I think I'm getting it right now. Mm. So he's still continually evolving.
How many Grammys has he won?
7.
Yeah. So he's after 7 Grammys, he's finally getting it right.
Yeah, and he's developed a love for a really good riff, which, you know, he was commenting on Neil Young's, you know, ability to create a great riff. Mm. So, see, the thing is that you don't stay... Life is about evolving. It's about changing and learning. And you can't be the person you were at 20. If you're cited in an interview when you're 24 and then 10 years later, you know, you have every right to have changed your mind, because hopefully you've done some living and some learning and adapting and changing. Surely that's what we're here to do, is just explore, for God's sake, you know?
I think that's what he's done. I mean, you say he's gone back to more song-based stuff. I mean, he is a good songwriter. He's a great songwriter, right? Over the years, Beauty of Wyoming. We just got that on vinyl the other day. It's a great Sony record. That's his second solo album. And he's always sort of surrounded his songs with great amounts of production and ambient stuff. Mm. But you strip them back and they're still great songs.
Do you remember that time? There's this piece in the interview when he's recording with Brian Blade and he's got these lyrics on a big sheet of paper on the floor, and he's going through the song explaining the meanings to Brian, and he's going, yeah, and I'm doing this, and he's really going for it, and explaining to Brian the feel and the meaning of the song so that he can respond to it, you know?
And it cuts between him actually explaining it and the actual bit of the track where Brian Blade's really laid into this fucking
biting his
kit,
lip,
you know?
Just really going,
going for it.
In a gentle way, yeah.
Well, the final track that we're going to hear today is a track, again, recorded in that period when he was in at New Orleans. And if I was to say it was probably one of the best tracks, recorded tracks that I've ever heard ever, you know, well, that's what I think. It's an amazing performance by a genius singer in New Orleans, done in somebody's kitchen. And he was sat down. I mean, all the things that you learn, you should never record vocalists sat down because the diaphragm's closed and they can't open the voice and all that. Well, that's okay. But every person I've seen Lanois record, Sinead O'Connor, this guy I'm going to tell you about in a minute, they're all fucking sat down. Mm. And him, he records sat down. So, you know, if you want to sound like this, it's a different sound. But on the video, this video we can't remember the name of, it shows him in action. And
can I just say one more thing before
you
play it? The first time you played this song to me, I'll always remember it because it took your soul and you cried.
I did, and I cry a lot, and I'm probably going to cry now.
Oh, my name, it means nothing. And my age, it means less. For the country I come from is called the Midwest. I was taught and brought up to the laws to abide, and that the land that I live in has God on its side. All the history books tell it, they tell it so well. The cavalry's charge and the Indians fell. The cavalry's charge and the Indians died. Oh, the country was young then, with God on its side. The Spanish American war had its day, and the Civil War to us was soon laid away. And the names of the heroes I was made to memorize, with guns in their hands and God on their side. The First World War boys, it came and it went, and the reason for fighting I never did get, but I learned to accept it with pride. For you don't count the day it went, God's on your side. In the 1960s came the Vietnam War. Can someone tell me what we were fighting for? So many young men died, so many mothers cried. Now I ask the question was caught on our side. I learned to hate the Russians all through my whole life. If another war comes, it's them we must fight. And to hate them and fear them, to run and to hide, and accept it all bravely, with God on my side. Through many dark hours, I've been thinking about this, that Jesus Christ was betrayed by a kiss. But I can't think for you, you have to decide whether Judas Iscariot had God on his side. Oh, now as I'm leaving, I'm weary as hell. The confusion I'm feeling, ain't no tongue can tell. The words fill my head, and they fall to the floor. That if God's on our side, he'll stop the next war. Jesus loves me, as I know.
With God on our side, Neville Brothers.
Yellow Moon. And I did cry again. The song, of course, is a Bob Dylan song. And Oh Mercy, the track we heard before, or track from that record we heard before, Bob Dylan asked Lanwha to produce it on the strength of this record and the strength of this particular track being recorded. It's very difficult to articulate the beauty and what he's managed to capture there. In that, the video, Here Is What Is. Is it Here Is What Is?
Yes.
We've finally found out what it is. Here Is What Is. I say it shows Aaron Neville, he's a big man, Aaron Neville. He looks like a boxer. He doesn't look like he's gonna say, he's got muscles like chapel at pegs, his mother would say. Great big bloody muscles in his arms. And he looks like a wrestler or a boxer something. Then he opens his mouth and he's got this falsetto, magnificent voice. But he was sat down when he did this. And Lanwha's there conducting the band in the kitchen. And the 24-track machine there whizzing around. So obviously there's a name, the noise from the 24-track machine. He doesn't give a fuck about the noise from the 24-track machine. He wants to make people feel good and right. And the vocal performance and the delivery there is unbelievable on the back of a great song.
It is unbelievable. It's magnificent. Just like there's this beautiful ray of light that just breaks through a dark cloud and just silently, gently opens up and gives you a big hug by the end of it.
Yeah. And he's, you know, he's the timing, and, you know, I'm sorry, Mariah, and I'm sorry, Celine, and I'm sorry, you know, all these hugely articulated vocalists who, woo-hoo! Now, he does a bit of that on there, you know, please, but that means something. What he's doing there means something. All this other shit I hear, as far as I'm concerned, doesn't mean it's vocal acrobatics and it just doesn't mean anything. He means every fucking word he's singing there.
It's a soul.
Yeah.
The soul's there, isn't it?
Yeah. And Lanois has captured it. And Lanois
Bravo.
Helped to create that magnificent song that will live forever, you know? So, that is our appreciation, or a short appreciation, of Daniel Lanois in his sort of his mid-period, his 80s and 90s period, really, which I think is, in my opinion, his finest work.
To date.
To date, yeah. I mean, he's, you know.
Yeah.
We have invited him to come to the studio when he's passing through Spain. We've been speaking to his people, and hopefully at some stage...
Well, yeah, he lives out of a suitcase a lot at the moment as well.
That's right. Very painful, I would have thought, living out of a suitcase. But anyway.
Yeah, and I really hope you make the time just to definitely listen to Arcady. I can't speak actually after that song. I'm sorry. I think we need to probably just stop there.
Well, yeah. The Arcady, Beauty of Wyona, and certainly, you know, Level Brothers, Yellow Moon, which is that track that was off, Bob Dylan, Oh Mercy. These are great albums.
And I'll tell you what you can't fault Lanois for, though, is he's totally passionate and committed. And inspired music just bursts out of him. And I love the fact that he's not judgmental in the room. He just wants to get you to be the best you, to go past perhaps your own limitations that in your own mind.
Yeah.
I think, and for that, I applaud him.
Well, so do I. And also, he's a very fine songwriter, fine producer, of course, and a fine guitar player. He creates a lot of great racket.
Yeah.
And I like the fact, I'm just bringing it up a bit now, because we're all a bit sad after that song. It's taken us a bit down. But he creates a fantastic fucking racket. He's got a little deluxe like mine. He gets down on his knees, and it feeds back, and he's really giving it some serious shit, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what we like, with his array of vintage guitars, lots of lovely echo on there. Anyway, thank you very much indeed for listening to the show.
Yeah.
You can, if you want to contact us, you can do so on Twitter. It's Susie and Simon at twitter.com. twitter.com/Susie and Simon.
Yes, indeed.
And then
if you want to send us an email at the show as well, if you've got any questions or anything, you know, any sort of comments about the show, any way you think we could, any features you'd like us to include, or you know, just say hello, you know, this is for you. And our email address is podcast@supertonerecords.com.
Yeah. So, yeah, thanks very much. And it's goodbye from Simon Campbell and...
Hasta luego from me.
Who's that? Who are you?
Me.
Ah, Susie Stilly Day.
Si.
Okay, cheers.
Adios. Bye.